Hey, I'm here with Wade Compton. He is a poet, DJ, a black historian born and raised in Vancouver. He's the author of various collections of poetry, including 49th Parallel Song and Performance Bond. He's also edited an anthology, Bluesprint, Black British Columbian Literature and Orature, and recently a collection of essays called After Cana. He's also been involved with the recovery of Hogan's Alley in Vancouver, a historically black neighborhood that was removed, I think it was in the 60s or 70s,
yeah.
Or a highway, I believe.
Yep. I mean, they started work on it in the late 60s and finished in the early 70s.
And I'm here also on behalf of the ICAST project. Much of my own work surrounds improvisation and music and poetry, and so I thought I would get things going by asking about that own relation to your work. In relation to your poetry, Winfried Simmerling describes improvisation as one of the responses to transcultural liminality in the contact zones of diasporic and transnational cultures. Through adaptation, appropriation, and sampling materials, backgrounds, and techniques, earlier repositories in the local present are combined to produce new effects and performance. So I'm wondering how improvisation and music more generally, thinking of the cadences of jazz and hip-hop and turntablism that appear in your work, function in your own kind of poesis, general thinking.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, there's sort of a few directions to go with that. Maybe start with identity, which is where, you know, a lot of my concerns originate, in figuring out my identity position, and which is not exactly why I started writing, but it's when I started working on that long project is when I think I became a serious writer, and so it's wrapped up in that for me. And the problem of identity for me has always been an unstable relationship to any tradition, or just any clarity around identity. And so I feel like that's the kind of core improvisation, you know, is just sort of figuring out what, where I fit in things and what I can pick up as an inheritance and what I haven't been able to, or what's been an approximation of a tradition, just my general relationship to authenticity. I think that the tension, right, the tension with traditions and when I was younger, wanting to have a stable identity position or a kind of authentic, but then even then, I remember wanting that stuff, and that sometimes overshadows my memory of what I actually knew. And when I look back at some of my early writing, I realized very, very early on, I'd already kind of accepted that, that the truth of it all was somewhere in the inauthenticity, and that there was that was okay. But I look back on it and I sort of remember being motivated by wanting something more stable. But when I look at it again, when I reread myself early on, I realize, well, I kind of knew. I was smart enough to know it wasn't really going to work like that. But then I think over the years it's gotten more and more. I've reconciled more and more with the fact that it's, who I am is very odd and unexplained, and it not so many precedents, and that's. That can be used, or that can be, or just has to be, actually, that's the case for me. So improvising blackness here, that's a lot of what it's all been about for me, is sort of figuring out what is this what is this place? What's my relationship to it? What's my relationship to the tradition? What's my relationship to race, racism, racial law, black solidarity and diaspora, and the movements that come out of that, and all of those things. So it's been really, you know, that's all improvisational. And I think that's why I've gravitated towards forms that are more experimental, or forms that are, you know, probing, you know, probing possibilities and looking around for different ways of doing things. And it's never felt all that comfortable to me to just pick up on something that's already been laid down. You know, even when I see it in other writers too, like, you know, writers who aren't dealing with those identity issues, I mean, you know, I'm intrigued by those formal explorations, because they might, you know, they might uncover some, you know, something new, something that that helps make, you know, helps reveal how it's going to work. How I'm gonna, whatever that means, you know, whatever that means.
So partially, I mean, the inauthenticity is, at times, is the authenticity, or is the discovery of that identity is mutable. It's in flux always. It's changing.
Yeah.
You know, Ralph Ellison talks about, you know, the jazzman. As soon as he finds himself, he loses himself. Right. So there's always this cyclical kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like music in some ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's complicated by the fact, like, you know. Well, I don't know. Maybe this is true of every you know, so this is every second generation immigrant's problem or something. Maybe that's there's that tension between you and the first generation parent who was steeped in it, whatever it was. And so, you know, because I see this in my friends who are, you know, the kids of Asian immigrants or European or whatever, right? So there's this tension. If your parents speak another language and they showed up here, and you grew up here, and so you don't, so you get that as a second language kind of thing. So maybe it's no different than that in a lot of ways. But it does feel like there's a particular, you know, the only ethnic group, I think, that sweat people more about authenticity than Black Americans are First Nations people.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, within African American culture, there's a real authenticity trip that you know what I mean? And with Americans, it's mostly wrapped up in language. It's less about color than it is about language.
Mm.
Right? If you don't speak, you know, African American vernacular English, you know, then just you're shut out. Right? Mm. It comes down to that. You can be as light skinned as me, but it, you know, but people can hear it. It's an expertise, and if you don't speak it, you are, you know, you're out. And if you do, it's, you know, then you're in. Like, that's the that's the border. That's the cultural marker.
And you always hear, I've heard of many African Canadians who go to the States, and all of a sudden they are no longer Black anymore. They're Canadian all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And so there's this double not belonging at times. Again, identity becomes extremely complex through borders and different nation states and nation languages. And
they totally don't know what to do with Canadians. Because Canadian, you know, Black Canadian come down there and they obviously are Black. And you know, obviously part of the diaspora in certain ways that they can recognize, but it's that language that trips them up, right? It's like my dad just found, like, Black folks with British accents. He just found them so odd. You know, he just found them so odd. You know, but that's a very American thing. And I would say First Nations people have that around, and it's a totally different, you know, historical set of circumstances, but I see that also, that there's this real, you know, authenticity has this, like, central pillar of the, really, how far you are from traditions and things like that. It's this measure that they, you know, put each other through all the time in just everyday greetings, and it pervades, you know, native to native discussions and all of that. It's part of the way. It's like, how far are we from the traditions? How far are you personally from it? How far am I, and how far are we in relation? It's this thing that goes on. I see from a distance, but I see that. And then I recognize a parallel in Black American culture, mm-hmm. Black North American culture too, that we do it too in a slightly different way. Our way seems to be all wrapped up in language and class.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, and maybe everybody does it. It's probably, you know, you get Polish American people, or you get, you know, Chinese Canadian or whatever, and everybody probably does it to some degree.
So it seems like one of the things you do in your work is kind of work with old traditions to kind of create new traditions, or constantly working through the tradition. And just to return to this notion of the cyclical, in Bluesprint, you talk about what Camus Braithwaite terms tidalectics, which provides an Africanist model for thinking about history. In an interview with Nathaniel Mackey, Braithwaite describes tidalectics as a way of interpreting history as a palimpsest. He says, "In other words, instead of the notion of 1, 2, 3 Hegelian, I am more interested in the movement of backwards and forwards as a kind of cyclic, I suppose, motion rather than linear." And so I find repetition as a type of circulation that's present throughout your work and your turntable poetics. For instance, you talk about the function of repetition as a Black ontological priority in the creation of newness, you say. Repetition, whether in the form of ancestor worship or the poem histories of the griot, informs Black ontologies more than does the Europeanist drive for perpetual innovation with its concomitant disavowals of the past. And similarly, to think about sampling, as sampling of forms, sampling as a technique, provides a new way of doing something that's been with us for a long time. It's kind of like Ezra Pound's calling on to make it new. Further, DJ Spooky talks about how the mix breaks free from old associations. New contexts form from old, the script gets flipped, the languages evolve and learn to speak in new forms, new thoughts. The sound of thought becomes legible again at the edge of new meanings. So I wonder if you could discuss repetition, circulation, tidalectic, sampling. I realize these are a lot of different elements, but maybe you could just touch on any of them and how building on this notion of tradition and inauthenticity is possibly a type of authenticity. If you can touch on any of that, fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, when I came across that, just in so many ways, Braithwaite is just vitally important for me. He's the most important writer. You know, his writing is the biggest influence on my writing, I think, and my thinking. And it's, you know, it's because, well, just that. So what I started off saying, you know, I'm attracted to formal innovation and, you know, experimentation and concept and, you know, writing that tries to go to the root of what it's doing and in a lot of ways start all over again every time you're creating something and try to figure out what's possible every time. You know, I'm trying to find non-cliched ways to describe you know, what a lot of people call experimental or avant-garde or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
But just work that doesn't just sort of happily receive and then carry on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm attracted to that and interested in that. And partly that's, I think, Vancouver. It's being here and just the set of, you know, mentors that I stumbled upon, you know, like George Bowering and George Stanley and, you know, folks like that. You know, from that generation, but also, like I said, yeah, this is really you know, I'm working on this identity problem, and you know, seeing someone like Kamau Braithwaite and reading his work, and then but seeing where he took it, you know, over the years, into this weirder and weirder forms, you know. But I love how it's always in relation to these, you know, this tradition that goes way far back, you know, and that it's, it doesn't work the way, you know, Euro-Canadian writers and Euro-American writers seem to set themselves up with their identity issues, you know, which, you know, so you look at writers in this country, conceptual writers right now, conceptual poets right now, you know, to me, you know, white writers drive me mad because they can't see around themselves so often, you know, and they don't recognize that they're an ethnic group.
Mm.
And the one of the issues of their ethnicity is that their people took over the world. So they tend to think that the stuff they're doing is the universal.
Mm.
And so, you know, whatever they're doing, which is their specific business, they proclaim as universal movements, conceptual poetry, they call it, right? And it's really just white folks' concerns when they become poets. And their white folks' concerns are to kill their parents, you know? They're punk rockers at heart, which is, you know, essentially counterculture is their core. And that doesn't work for us, you know? That does not work for us at all. We don't want to kill our parents because our parents barely survived. And they're, you know, they carry the means of our liberation in their, you know, everyday business, you know? And so that conceptual stuff doesn't work for us because it wants to, you know, destroy tradition. And they're on and on about that. Like, if you read Derek Bolio or people like that, they're on and on about, I mean, tradition is their boogeyman. That's their bête noire is tradition. Mm. And they think killing it is the, will save them and save us all because they are us all, right? Mm. That's how they see it. It drives me mad. Because I just say, you know what? Like, go say everything you're saying to, you know, a native poet in this country and see how it plays, right? You wouldn't dare. You wouldn't dare, you know, say kill your tradition and overthrow it and all that. So if that doesn't work, then, you know, you should acknowledge that this is my own section of the world's trip, and perhaps it's all, you know, perhaps it works and perhaps it doesn't, you know. So anyway, it doesn't work for me. Like, so a lot of what I'm doing, you know, to me, Brathwaite has it right. Mm. It's that it's not a dialectic.
Mm.
And I think that conceptual position most of the time, when you can pin them down to actually sort of say what they're trying to do, it'll reveal the dialectic. They're working in the dialectic still. You know, the synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? They're working towards some kind of synthesis. And I like that Brathwaite liberates us from that. Says, no, you're just part of the chain, right? You're just part of this long chain of things. Even if you're innovating, you know, you are still part of this long series of things. And you can flip it to be almost completely opposite. And in fact, there are points when you probably should, but it still gets folded back, like that tithe. It still gets folded back into, you know, what came before it, and then the next thing you did, and then somebody else, you know, brings it back and brings it up again. And there's something much more humble in that, I think, too, in that you're just, you're part of this thing that you can't completely get a grip on. Mm. And so it's also less of that kind of romantic kind of myth. There's less of that in it. You know, I mean, I know, you know, postmodernism tries to get rid of that anyway, but I think it hangs on, you know, the individual agent still hangs on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that...
Because I remember, I thought the way he talks about, right, postmodernism shouldn't be chronologically defined, right, that it should be more, you know, more of a way of operating, right, and then that therefore it's not just belonging to one kind of social movement, I think, potentially.
Yeah, in which case, I agree, right? In which case, because I think, you know, Kamau Brathwaite is a postmodern writer then, right? And I think he'd be okay with that, too. I don't know.
And would you consider yourself a postmodern writer?
Yeah, I think so. And, or at times, I don't know, I mean, maybe not all the time, but, yeah.
And so I want to touch on some of the identity politics you brought up, and thinking within a strictly kind of some of the writers you admire and your own sphere of influence, your concern with the local in Texas, for example, like Blues Print, you're uncovering a much of the history of Hogan's Alley. In Blues Print, you talk about how British Columbia's black history has been one of continued exodus, immigration, settlement, exploration, miscegenation, communitarianism, integration, segregation, agitation, uprooting and rerooting and rerouting. And so to build on the last question, I wonder if you could talk about the importance of history to your work, particularly in relation to black British Columbian literary history. And do you see your archival work as fitting into a larger national or potentially transnational project?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's part of what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. So part of what I have to do is situate myself in a history that wants to forget,
mm-hmm.
Our past. So I ended up doing a lot of that work, kind of falling into it backwards in a lot of ways, and I'm coming out of it. It's been a strange journey because in around the year 2000 was kind of the peak of, or maybe shortly after, was really the peak of my need for this stuff, like really wanting to, it was just an aching, raw need to understand black history in the province and in Western Canada, and just a basic understanding, and that really came out of ignorance. I think that's where the raw need comes from, is just out of a blank space that's despair, right? It's just a despairing feeling to have completely no understanding of how you got here and how this happened and how it all worked, how it all works, why it works like this. And I feel like, so I did years and years of that work, trying to bring the city up to speed at least, and try to say, and I think it was about getting a basic understanding myself. Then it was an activist project. It was a collective project with a bunch of other people, which is the Hogan's Alley Memorial Project. And where we were at first focused on a memorial, like a public memorial. And then as we got it rolling, we quickly realized we didn't know much. So then it became more about information, consciousness raising and information gathering. So both for ourselves and for other people, which is a weird experience of learning it and teaching it at the exact same time. That's sort of what we're doing, trying to understand it. Like literally just walking around down there trying to figure out where things were, just geographically, in terms of Black Vancouver. And then at the same time doing an interview, doing that one weekend and the next weekend doing an interview about it, which is not normally how it works, right? So it was that was the experience, and then I was also trying to cope with it in my writing as well.
But, sort of as a master's project, right?
So that problem pervades the work. And then, I mean, what's happened lately is, if you want me to bring it up to now, what happened was there's a lag. And so I would say now, right now, and or maybe the last 2 years or 3 years, I felt it really worked, A lot of that activism has worked. And it feels to me like people understand. People in Vancouver understand that there was a black community in a way they didn't. And I think a lot of it has to do with what we did. Like, I think we did raise a lot of, a lot of people's, level of understanding about the history, black history of the city. And now it's coming in official recognition, too. So there's the plaque that just went in down there earlier this year, that's from Heritage Vancouver. And there's another public art piece that's happening, and we get city councilors know about it, so it feels to me like it's kind of working. Now the problem for me is that now these things are starting to roll in officially, and I'm exhausted of doing it, and so I'm on to other things. I'm not So the book of short stories that I'm working on now does not mention Hogan's Alley at all, or even really Black history, and the Black history of the city. It's all about the city, now and in the future.
Mm.
So it starts in 2001 and goes past, past 2013. But it's very that's very deliberately done because I'm just exhausted at the subject, and I'm kind of I feel bad because now things are rolling in, and so people are awake to it and excited about it that are either a little younger than me, or Black folks who are a bit younger than me, or non-Black Vancouverites who are interested and want to do something with it, who are just kind of late to discovering it and are working on projects and things. And I've always been very, all through it, I was a real, I thought this was a multicultural project. All through, I was pretty, I made a decision early on that it's not just for Black folks, that this is the history of the city. And there were a lot of, we got a lot of help from non-Black people, and I thought that was right and how it should be. And so I'm happy that that's, in fact, they should be doing some of the work. I think it's, if they're excited by it, they should be doing it, because it makes it richer. So I'm really glad all those people are excited by it, but I'm just so, it's just, it's not ideological, it's just me being tired of it.
But now there's momentum, and before there, there wasn't momentum when you were starting, right?
Yeah.
So in many ways, you can now step aside, I think.
Yeah, and I really, really want to. And I think it's a good thing. I had good advice from some people along the way, like Roy Meakey, you know, who just is such a great, just a great presence for me. And, you know, he, and just also very humble and a great activist and a very principled activist. And he said to me at one point about what he was doing that, you know, you just, you don't want to be proprietary about social movement stuff because it will, if you hang on to it, you'll start hurting it at a certain point. If you start doing it for you, it, you'll start hurting it, right? And there's a certain point where you step out and other people are supposed to come in and take it over and criticize you for what you missed and all that. And that's part of the, you should bow out at a certain point. And so I'm trying to do that. And I see why, why he said that is true.
And that's the other end of identity, right, is community, right? Is at some point, can start off for you, but then the idea is to form some notion of community and a community of, of history, a community of interpretations. People bring their own stories and interpretations, obviously, to any project. And so I guess the last question that I'll ask here will be directly about your own kind of performance, kind of off the page, and having seen you perform your work a couple of times where you deal with notions of, you know, hybridity and different forms emulated via the music's own polyphonic and hybridized layering of sound and thematic. And I saw you perform some pieces from Performance Bond a couple of years ago. The performance involved a sampler and three turntables. Sampler played a vocal sample of you reading from your poem, The Reinventing Wheel, and while the entire performance was cued to various like hip-hop and electro beats, with the aid of co-performative author, his name's Jason Bakuda, and you illustrate this type of performance in your recent essay, Turntable Poetry, Mixed Race, and Schizophonophilia. In the essay, you describe schizophonophilia as the love of audio interplay, the pleasure of critical disruptions to natural addition, the counter-hegemonic affirmation that can be achieved through acoustic intervention. And I really like this notion of acoustic intervention, the notion of disrupting the pretense of naturalism as a reminder that democracy, as embodied in sound, is itself most effective when it is most discordantly free. Schizophonophilia and the way you self-reflexively approach your work makes me think about what Adrian Piper calls the indexical present. Quote, I use the notion of the indexical present to describe the way in which I attempt to draw the viewer into a direct relationship with the work, to draw the viewer into a kind of self-critical standpoint which encourages reflection of one's own responses to the work. And it gets me also to think about here how poesis can be kind of an act of citizenship where you're having to negotiate difference. And you mentioned multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is also this kind of negotiation of difference, of different cultures, of different ways of being in the world. And schizophonophilia and music as well, once again, is a negotiation of multiple kind of elements to kind of make sense and form your own identity within that kind of mix, the creative mix. And so I wonder what it means for you to perform your work live in that kind of self-reflexive way. I know a lot of creativity for yourself and for artists performing in this fashion is about how you recontextualize the previous expressions of others. So once again, going back to identity, to kind of go cyclical and end where we started, how do you manage to find your own voice within the polyphony of so many others?
Mm-hmm.
If you could touch on schizophrenophilia at all, it's a great term.
Yeah, I'll start by saying it's kind of funny because that essay and what I, you know, I'm using Armory Schaefer as a kind of foil in it, but you know, just to say this off the top, it's really funny because I'm a big Armory Schaefer fan, you know, so
that almost seems perfect for the term in a way, though, right?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. It's weird. I'm not sure how I've arrived at this place, but you know, I find him just so compelling. Like, so maybe that's the reason why it's an interesting place to start, or it's interesting to work against him because his ideas are really compelling.
Mm-hmm.
And but looking at them, I had, you know, have to come down on, you know, on the side of you know, polyphony and you know, electronic reproduction, and you know, and so there's some things it does seem that he's kind of wrong about, but he's just wrong in such a great way and such a compelling way, you know, and just the work he's done is fascinating, and just sort of like, you know, sound mapping and you know, pointing out the lost history of sound, and you know, it's one thing we lose. And I was interviewing George Bowring last night for Summer Rights here at Continuing Studies, and he talked, how did it come up anyway, but he was talking about writing on a typewriter in the days when he wrote on typewriters. He said at night, because there's so many writers in Kitsilano, he would walk down the street, he would come home from the bar and walk down the street in Kitsilano, and he would hear, in the summer, when people's windows were open, and you would just hear typewriters, like walking down the street,
wow.
You'd hear like typewriters,
yeah.
And that. And you just think, and Murray Schaefer talks about this specifically in The Tuning of the World, about how there are lost sounds, like we won't remember that apart from oral history, because it doesn't get recorded anymore.
Mm.
And if you think further back, before recording, there are all sorts of sounds that are just lost, except for in written descriptions here and there, but those just seem to be, you know, by chance that they get written down, and every once in a while you stumble across one and you think, oh, that's how it sounded back then, or in that place back then, and you just realize how that whole aspect of human life is just bypassed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm fascinated by that. So that's my archival instinct. That's
so DJ also as an archivist in a
sense. Yeah,
right.
So the DJ is this person who notices sounds, but electronic sounds, like recorded sounds, and the pastiche of all of that, right? And so, but I love how DJs are these just creatures of the crate, you know?
Mm.
They're just kind of, you know, Jason's better at it than I am, but, you know, when Jason and I travel, whenever we do a show, the kind of, you'll know this, right? Whenever we do a show somewhere, what the part of the show that people don't see is that the day before or the day after, we go, you know, record store shopping, or, you know, we look in the local thrift stores.
Yeah.
And so we do the show, that, you know, and they've flown us in or something, and we do the show. But it's part of the performance, kind of, is that we're just like, wow, we're in Kamloops. We've never been here before. I wonder what the thrift stores will have. And we'll go in there and we'll find, like we did in Kamloops, we found a dub plate that was unmarked. And we're like, what is this thing?
Yeah.
Who knows what's on this? The dub plate in the Salvation Army in Kamloops.
Yeah.
Got it back to the house, played it, and it was a dub plate. It was an acetate that someone made of a hockey game, of a peewee hockey game.
Oh, cool.
Like the commentary to the hockey
wow.
game someone put on a record a long time ago that ended up in the Salvation Army and that we bought.
Wow.
And it was just the weirdest, you know, it was the city. Like, that was...
And did you guys use that in that
no,
performance?
No, we didn't. It was so scratched up,
mm-hmm.
you could barely hear it, but still, you know, just even the stuff you don't use, it's just... That's... what the DJ does, right?
It's part of the listening process. It's always always listening. I mean, yep. I live in Toronto where there's 30 record shops, but I'm in Vancouver for 20 minutes before I met you, and I went and bought some records.
I knew it, yes, right, yeah.
That's just what you do, right?
And it's, you know what I mean by it's part of the, I don't know, it is part of the performance, because things that we buy that day might end up in the performance or in the next one. And it, yeah, that is, that's just so cool. Who else does that? And it's just such a wonderful part of it all, you know, is just sifting through the detritus of everything. I mean, I love that project, and I still want to keep doing it. Part of what I'm stopped by a little bit now is just the shifting technologies. It feels to me like the next step is to do something different off the turntables, maybe, but I can't figure out how.
They don't even manufacture the Technics 1200s anymore, which was,
when I heard that, I felt like I'd been stabbed or something like that. It just felt like, how can you not make those anymore? It's just
well, I guess they last 30 years.
That's hard.
They're not profitable in today's day and age, where people are rebuying their electronics every couple of years.
That's what made me feel better. It's like, you know, if you have one of those record players from the first year they made them, it will play.
It will play for the rest of
It's like the Singer sewing machines that were, you know, built like a tank and it will last forever. So yeah, there's probably enough in the world. I even think I read the number, you know, there's something like 3 million of them in the world right now.
So they'll live on.
We won't run out of Techniques 1200s, but it still just feels weird that they're not being made anymore. But it made me really want to protect mine.
You know, buy some extra ones. Have a garage of them.
But have a seed vault of them or something. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I love doing that performance, and working with Jace is just so cool. I'm not a talented DJ at all. Like, you know, I learned to DJ specifically to do this poem.
But you poet like a DJ, so.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's and I think it has something to do with what my relationship to it is. My kind of neophyte status is it's partly. Sometimes it really takes. It's like the best music writers are the ones who were almost musicians, or you know what I mean. Tried it, and weren't great, and so they really understand, or really appreciate people who could do it at this great level. I feel like I'm sort of like that. Like, I know enough about it to really get it. Like, I was looking at some of Kid Koala's videos on YouTube, and I'm just, it's just this ache where you're just like, man. I could do that.
He's incredible. Every time I see him, I can't touch my turntables for a week.
Exactly. Yeah. It makes you almost angry that, you know, this guy got to have this talent. And I just think he's the best DJ I've seen.
He's incredible,
And I've seen him live several times, you know, in Vancouver, the Planetarium at the Commodore. I remember watching him at the Commodore. I had a spot right on the side of the stage. So I was right, I just could watch his hands through the whole thing. And I just, there were certain points when I was looking at it saying, you can't do that. You can't do the thing I'm watching you do. It just can't be done. And yet you're doing it.
And he's doing it on something where that's not even supposed to be possible in the first place. Which is so interesting, talking about, you know, new forms. And
But then again, but what's frustrating is, I'm just like, you know, his content is so empty. It's frustrating because I'm just like, why don't you... And it's not even just empty. It's actually... He undercuts himself, right? It's really... this is the problem I have with hip-hop, which I don't understand the origins of it, is the childishness of hip-hop, which has turned me away from it in recent years, where I'm just... I don't understand why it's such a childish culture. You know what I mean? It's just this... Action movies and nostalgia and, you know, the you know, I mean, if you compare, you know, if you compare hip hop to jazz, right, and you sort of look at it, it's like black men from this generation compared to black men of the '60s, And you look at those guys, and they seem so mature by comparison in their subject matter and how they were on the world stage. They're also underground. They're all underground artists.
And bebop wasn't as popular as, you know, people. Everybody plays bebop in the schools now, but I mean, Thelonious Monk was playing to like four people.
Right. So,
which is hard to think that would be possible. Right?
Yeah. It makes it different. And I do sometimes think, I mean, maybe it's just because the jazz guys didn't have to talk much.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we didn't hear their immaturity necessarily, right?
Yeah.
So maybe they're just the same as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, knowing when not to talk is a kind of maturity in a way,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you look at interviews with Miles Davis, and he was just, you know, shrewd with what he revealed and thoughtful about it. So, I don't know, I just don't...
I feel like he could be a tough kind of son of a bitch too, like if you read Miles, but yeah, I think.
Yeah, and Mingus, you know, yeah, I mean.
But at the same time, they were incredibly articulate at times and made this absolutely
back and forth,
beautiful,
right?
You know, passionate music.
Yeah, they could talk about form.
Mm.
I mean, maybe it has something to do with, there's a class issue, which is funny because a lot of those guys were middle class, but not all of them were.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was like one or two generations outside of being poor. So, I don't know, whereas hip-hop makes a fetish of being, you know, lumpen proletarian.
Mm.
So, I don't know, but
it gets more complex when you get the recording industry and the history of that, too, and the monetization of everything.
Yeah, they are marketing to 12-year-old boys, so
mm-hmm.
they keep it in the language of 12-year-old boys or something like that, but it's frustrating, you know. Anyway, I see that in Kikwa. It's like, I guess he's inherited that general aesthetic. And so it's all just, it just doesn't attempt much. It's really unambitious.
Mm.
It's very ambitious in terms of sound, pure sound. It's so ambitious.
Mm.
And I just can't fathom the skill he has. But I often think if you paired that, you know, this was a sound so tragic. I'm just like, if I could do that, I could do what he was doing and what I would do with it. Would be...
Have you heard some of his recent projects, like 12-Bit Blues, where he goes and digs to the archives of old blues music?
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And his Space Cadet stuff, so I think he is trying to mix in some new sounds.
I hope so. I just want him to do... You know, when he did that performance of Moon River, right?
Yeah,
and he
amazing.
Said it's because his mom... Yeah, I think it's one of the most the best
mom,
thing he
right?
did.
Yeah,
he's. Cause I think the full story is his mom didn't understand that he was could be doing this and how this was his job, and so he said, "Okay, what's your favorite song? And I'll do a version of it, and maybe we'll meet here somewhere. You'll understand sort of." And then he did it, and it's the most beautiful thing he's done.
Mm.
And so, I'm just like, okay, be brave, keep doing that kind of thing, like. Do something that's you or your context or your family or negotiating with ideas or thoughts in some kind of way. Because most of the time it's very surface and not even surface in a... It's just not analytical in any kind of way. I just thought, man, the power could be there. If you were. But anyway, so I'm the other side of it. I'm just like the most rudimentary, skillless DJ. But I mean, I work with Jason, who is very talented and is, you know... So then it becomes this complex where we are both sort of, you know, working some of my ideas and then his ability to execute things. And so it's, but anyway, yeah, it feels very, like I want to keep doing it, but I don't know where to go with it. But I'll come back around to sound. The sound is so important to me.
Have you thought about doing more recordings?
Yeah, I'd like to. I don't know how to do. I don't know where it goes now. And my head's really in prose right now, so it's. I'm not even really thinking about it actively. But I will. It's something I want to keep doing. But I don't know how to do it exactly or where, what the next thing is. But I also find, I don't know. Technology shifts so quickly now. There's new things. So quickly that I don't know. I want to engage with. But that's the other beauty. You know, the beauty of hip hop is. You know, it's still, like someone like Kid Koala is still vinyl. He's still a vinyl guy, vinyl and turntables guy. It's all still there. And so, talking about tradition, you know, he is working in a with the traditional tools that are old tools now. 40-year-old tools, well, older than that.
Yeah.
The setup is a 40-year-old setup. And, you know, but anyway, it does feel like there's something working with the new. Because we are at a different level of sound culture. Like, I don't know what it is, but...
Well, that's the exciting part of it, right, I guess, in many ways. And there is persistent truth in, you know, Marshall McLuhan's notion that, you know, the medium is the message and the message, right? I think we're still working through.
Yeah, I mean,
I
get excited talking about it because there's something to be done there, and I don't know what it is, but...
Yeah. We eagerly await.
Yeah, we'll see. I know, and maybe I won't do it, but somebody will. And, yeah, but we'll find out.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Wade. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Okay, so this is from a story called British Columbian Blues by Vitruvius Daly. And in the scene, it's two brothers. They were conjoined twins who were separated later in life. And now one of them is a musician and the other is trying to be a documentary filmmaker, making a film about their family. Albert steps out of the key of C and into A, while Michael walks the bass line in circles, and Werner punctuates the departure with some skittering rim work. The Bachelard room is a supper club, so Albert can only go so far outside. He has to be careful not to completely alienate the tourists and foodies and couples on dates. But he's familiar with this edge and knows just how many liberties he can afford to take per set. He hunches over his Gibson, balanced atop his bar stool on the little stage. His fingers and his mind move apart and together. He is levitating in all directions, outwardly and inwardly. Donald, with the camcorder cradled on his shoulder, snakes in and amongst the trio, focusing an extreme close-up on Michael's fretboard for a moment, then moving on to film the bell of Werner's ride. Then he closes in on Albert's pickguard, tightening on his right-hand work. Donald squats in front of his brother, putting the camera up close to the guitar's body, the lens just a few centimeters from Albert's right hand. Albert leans back and pulls a note north, like a man hiking a catamaran against the wind. He's aware of his brother down there near his feet, but he shuts his eyes, pursues the sound. Donald tries to stand up out of his squat, holding the shot, but he's unsteady on the balls of his feet. He loses his balance and tips forward. The eye of the camcorder touches Albert's knee, then Donald rights himself into a crouch and backs away. Albert keeps tinkering in A, reaching for the crow. That's what their father taught them to call improvisation. When they were kids, the old man said to them that musicians are magicians, pleasers, entertainers. What you do is no different from sawing a woman in half or making a coin vanish. But Albert and Donald's father also told them that there is a maze that the music makes, and there are moments when you are a magician reaching into your top hat for the rabbit you hid there earlier, and instead of a rabbit, you pull out a crow. The trick tricks you. That's what the best music is. You reach for the crow when you know there's nothing but a rabbit in there. Yes, it's only a supper club, and Albert is only running through old standards for distracted tourists. But Albert is reaching for the crow, nevertheless. It takes a kind of non-concentration, a kind of self-obliteration. And there is his brother, a frigging camcorder all up in his face, all up in his conjuring. Rabbit. No crow. Just rabbit. Albert scribbles out a few more notes in A, then looks up and over at Michael, signals for the chorus, and goes there. Michael catches it and follows, but cocks his head as if to say, "What's wrong?" Werner halts altogether, but quickly punts with a strong crash and finds them on the one. As the chorus drags forward, a freckling of red appears on Albert's white pickguard. Several droplets of blood spray against the plastic during his crab-like picking. A woman in the audience says, "Oh my God." A few people point. Albert brings the song home quickly. When it's over, he holds up his ring finger and examines it in the spotlight. He turns it towards the audience to show them, Then he shows it to Michael, who just stands there, shaking his head. Werner shrugs and starts to unscrew his cymbals. Donald zooms the camera out, steps back off the stage, panning the trio now. Albert leans towards his microphone. "I'm sorry, folks. It looks like I cut my finger. I'm very sorry, but we'll have to stop the show. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope we'll see you again." He turns the volume down on his Gibson and unplugs it. There is a little applause. Michael taps him on the shoulder. "What the fuck?" Albert ignores him and looks instead at Donald. He says, "Shut the camera off." "No, I want to get this." "Shut it off, or I swear to God I'll snatch it out of your hands." Donald lowers the camera. "What's your problem?" Werner comes around the drums, and the four of them stand in a cluster on the stage. The sound man puts a CD on, and the room fills with pre-recorded contemporary. Albert makes a grab for his brother's camera, but Donald pulls it back just in time. "All right." He hugs the camcorder to his chest, away from Albert. "Look, I'm pressing stop, you fucking psycho." Albert points his finger in his brother's face so that the tip is just beneath Donald's nose, and he says, "That's it. That's all the footage you'll get of me." Then he takes his guitar and leaps over the monitor, walks through the kitchen doors, and is gone. Donald is left there with the band. "What the hell was that?" Werner looks at Donald and says, "It was the last footage you'll get of him, apparently." Michael kicks Albert's stool, sending it clattering to the floor. He curses loudly and drags his Engelhart off the stage by its dark neck.